rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Also filling in for Al Franken this week and next. Is health care, you know, in the Constitution, the preamble of the Constitution talks about one of the seven primary reasons, or arguably six reasons, depending on how you slice and dice the thing, that the United States was created was to promote the general welfare. Does that mean that health care is a right, or is it merely a privilege? A debate that is coming to higher and higher profile as Senator Ron Wyden has introduced a universal health care proposal, or will be introducing it into Congress in the 110th Congress. And Yaron Brook is with us. He is the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org, their website. Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and other books and articles that led to the objectivist movement, which Yaron so well defends and represents. And I think one of the really valuable and useful things about talking to folks from AynRand.org is that this is the thinking behind the thinking of libertarians, who I refer to as Republicans who smoke pot, and the Newt Gingrich variety of Republican conservatives. Although Yaron, I know that those guys are totally off your radar screen, and you don't want to affiliate yourself with them. Nonetheless, they're sure borrowing a lot of ideas from Ayn Rand. Welcome to the program, Yaron.
Thanks for having me on.
Universal health care. You say not only is it not a right, but it's immoral. You say to have universal health care system.
That's right. It's not a right. I don't think anything is a right if it's, in order to enforce it, it violates other people's rights. So in order to have universal health care, we have to violate average Americans' rights by taxing them, by taking away their property. We have to violate doctors' rights by forcing them to treat people they might not want to treat or at prices that where they would not want to treat them. Rights are about leaving people alone. Rights are about taking force, taking coercion, all forms of coercion, government coercion and individual coercion, the equation. It's about leaving people to live their lives and, you know, make the most of them or make nothing of them. It's their business.
But here, a couple of simple facts here. The United States ranks 23rd in infant mortality. We are 20th in life expectancy for women and 21st in life expectancy for men. We rank below Canada and every other industrialized nation in virtually any disease you want to name. Heart disease, kidney failure, cancer. We rate very poorly relative to the rest of the world. And yet we spend 40% more on health care on a per capita basis than any other industrialized country in the world. This is what your privatized health care system has brought us. A for-profit health care system has brought us. A system that doesn't work, that has more people that are sick, that has 40 million people who have no insurance whatsoever, and that is costing us a fortune, while William McGuire, the president of the second largest health insurance company in the United States, last year made a $1.78 billion paycheck. $1,780 million. That's like, what, five? That's almost $1 million an hour, assuming an 8-hour day, 40-hour week? What's wrong with this picture, Yaron?
First, it doesn't matter the rankings. You don't sacrifice some people's rights in order to raise your rankings in a particular
survey. But what if we, the people, collectively decided to? Okay,
and you can slice and dice the numbers. I've seen a variety of different statistics. Some of them confirm what you say, some of them don't. But you don't violate some people's rights in order to raise yourself on the stat sheets. Second, I'm an opponent of the existing system as well. I agree with you. The existing system is awful because what drives costs up in the existing system, what reduces the quality of health care in the existing system is government mandates, government bureaucracy, Medicare and Medicaid, government purchases of drugs, HMOs, all the different tax benefits that are given to particular forms of medical insurance versus others that are not given those tax benefits. I want the government completely out of the system. I want a truly privatized health
system. No more FDA.
I would bet you anything that under such a system, Not only would the U.S. be ranked number one in every one of those statistics, but we would be ranked number one way ahead of anybody else in the world.
Well, what you have described is exactly the system that I would guess probably about half the countries in the world have. I've worked in a lot of those countries, in third world countries where the government has no, there's no healthcare system, they don't monitor drugs, you can walk into any store and buy any drug you want just over the counter, they don't even have, you know, prescription standards, in several African countries I've worked in are like that.
They're not
healthcare paradises.
But that's also the system the United States had. Pre-World War II, and it probably had the best healthcare system in the world pre-World War II. It's exactly this kind of health system we had when doctors used to do house calls. Remember those days where they...
I do remember those days, and at that time, hospitals were required by law to be not-profit organizations. As were health insurance companies.
It was completely private. Government did not intervene. Government didn't dictate the form in which healthcare was provided.
Not true.
These ridiculous incentives that they provide today.
Not true. Government required that the healthcare business be a not-for-profit business. Blue Cross Blue Shield was not for profit. Hospitals were not for profit.
Those house calls were full profit. They charged for them. They just charged. They charged amounts that allowed the doctors to make a living. The government didn't mandate the doctors.
There are still doctors who will do house calls, Yaron. You think that Donald Trump has to go to his doctor's office?
No, I think it's great that Donald doesn't have to do it. I pay my doctor a set fee every year.
So he takes me.
Rich get better health care. You know what? Rich people drive better cars. Rich people live in bigger homes. They deserve that. They've worked hard for it.
So here's the question.
It's wrong to take health care from them in order to give other people health care. It's wrong. Egalitarianism, equality, poverty, more.
Here's the question, Yaron. Yep. If we the people collectively, if we as a society in this constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, if we collectively say, more than 50% of us say,
yep.
We want to make sure that there is nobody among us who is sick. We want to make sure that everybody in this country has access to health care. And so we're going to simply say everybody is part of Medicare or Medicaid. We're going to create a universal health care system like the other 36 of the 37 industrialized nations of the world have done in one form or another, whether it's a socialized medicine form like the Veterans Administration or whether it's a single-payer system like Medicare and Medicaid. If we the people say we're going to do this, what's wrong with that?
That is wrong, just the same way as when Athens decided that Socrates, by a 60 to 40 or whatever the margin was, that Socrates
elected by one vote, wasn't he?
I think by one vote. So 51-49 decided that he should die. And denied his free speech. Rights are not up for voting.
I would suggest that you read E.F. Stone's book on Socrates.
I don't believe this country is a democracy. I believe that we are a constitutional republic where individual rights, including property rights, including the right of doctors to do what they want to do, are protected, and therefore majority, it doesn't matter what the majority size is, the majority should not be able to dictate what an individual can or cannot do.
So to hell with democracy.
I've never been a proponent for democracy. I think democracy is a bad system. I think the founding fathers believed, if you read Madison, if you read Jefferson, they did not believe in democracy. They believed in individual rights. Individual rights mean that no majority, no matter how large, can take away my right to speak, your right to speak, our right to property, our right to pursue happiness. We have a right to do whatever we want to do, as long as we don't hurt other people. We have a right to do whatever we want to do, and no majority should have the ability to stop us.
Yeah, well, I would respectfully disagree. Having written two books about Jefferson and knowing a fair amount about Madison, to whom I'm related, Madison, for example, in his first vetoed a bill that would have given money to churches to care for the poor in Washington, D.C. And in his veto message, he explicitly said that it was the responsibility of the government to care for the destitute and the poor. He just didn't want the money going through a church because he was afraid that it would corrupt the ministers in the church to get government money.
That might be, but Madison also wrote extensively about the dangers and ills of democracy, and he created...
Oh, you're talking about Federalist number 10.
Yeah, yes.
And then later, after he became president, after he had retired from being president, he said, you know, in Federalist Number 10, where I redefined democracy, because prior to 1787, when he wrote Federalist Number 10, the word republic and the word democracy were interchangeable. He said, we just basically created that artificial distinction to sell the Constitution. We are a democracy. You know, later in his life, Madison basically recanted that.
Well, then I agree with the young Madison and disagree
rather than the old Madison.
Over here.
Okay.
So my point is that I think democracy is a bad system. I think it's proved bad everywhere it's been tried. I think that the primary political concept here is individual rights, is the right of the individual to be left alone and for government to stay out of my life, my bedroom, what I believe in, what I think, what I say, and out of my property as well.
Okay, Yaron Brook, he's the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Yaron, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour in the Tom Hartmann radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Air America Radio with Tom Hartmann on the Al Franken Show.
Got my tonsils out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it healthcare, and I guess they got it good.
And welcome back. Exposing the con and conservative. These stories just from the New York Times, just in the last couple of days. Study questions colonoscopy effectiveness. They studied 12 highly experienced board-certified gastroenterologists and found that some were 10 times better than others at finding adenomas, the polyps that can turn into cancer. What was the difference? To quote Dr. Barclay, one of the group, all of these guys had done more than 3,000 colonoscopies in their life, right? And they found that some doctors were 10 times, that's 1,000% more competent, better at finding colon cancer or the precursors of it. He said, quote, if our group is representative of an average group, you will see people who take 2 or 3 minutes and people who take 20 minutes to examine a colon. Insurers pay doctors the same no matter how much time they spend. Great. So you have 1/100th the chance of having your colon cancer found because your doctor's trying to make an extra buck. And then from today's New York Times, Eli Lilly said to play down risk of top pill. The drug maker Eli Lilly is engaged in a decade-long effort to play down the health risks of Zyprexa, its best-selling medication for schizophrenia, according to hundreds of internal Lilly documents and email messages among top company managers. This company made Lilly $4.2 billion last year. By Zyprexa has by far become Lilly's best-selling product. But as early as 1999, 7 years ago, documents show that Lilly was worried about side effects. And actually, here's how they say it. But as this is from Alex Berenson's piece in the New York Times. But as early as 1999, the documents show that Lilly worried that side effects from Zyprexa, whose chemical name is olanzapine, would hurt sales. That's what they were concerned about, that it would hurt sales. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Absolutely mind-boggling. Randy, driving in Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy, welcome to the program. Randy, you're on the air. Randy must be listening to his radio rather than his telephone, so we will try Ken in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program.
Yes, I really got a kick out of that Ayn Rand guy. You know, individual rights presupposes a level playing field. And he sounds as if every one of these, whom I call the banksters and the corporados, made their money by the sweat of their brow. They made it by cheating, by skirting the laws. By
not all of them.
It.
Not and, all of them, but some of them, sure.
Well, a lot of them, and they...
The fact of the matter is, as Warren Buffett said, pointing out that he was the richest man in the world, or the second richest man in the world at the time, he said, had I been born in Bangladesh, I would not be the richest man in the world, no matter how smart I am. And that's really the bottom line.
Well,
some of us are more equal than others.
These guys have found whether they buy congressmen or the credit card lobby, the banking lobby boasted that the bankruptcy law, which was the first law, was passed after the Bush administration took power. They boasted that the law was passed word for word exactly as they wrote it.
Yeah.
Now, what does that have to do with individual rights?
Yeah, no, it has absolutely nothing to do with individual rights, and all the more the problem. Thank you very much, Ken, for the call.
By the way, the health care, I wanted to mention what you talked about health care. I remember in the 60s and 70s when we had these community not-for-profit hospitals,
yeah.
Wall Street realized that there was money to be made. They went from community to community, bamboozled the boards of directors of these community-based non-profit hospitals and bought them out and made it part of their corporation.
Wasn't just Wall Street. That's how Bill Frist's daddy became one of the 50 richest people in America. And that's how Bill Frist made his fortune, was by buying up formerly not-for-profit hospitals and taking them for profit. And, you're absolutely right. Chris in Sacramento, California. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The Ayn Rand guy is so incorrect. Ted Kennedy said just a few days ago, and this is the information that we're going to hear now that he's going to become the head of the committee to head health and welfare, that all of us who are insured pay 30% more for our health care because of the uninsured. So would he rather have a tax that he knows about or the tax that's already occurring?
Right.
You know,
and that's his point, is that if none of us paid for the uninsured, if we just let them die, then he wouldn't have to pay any extra tax. You have to get it. That's the ultimate point here, is it's all about the libertarian worldview, and which Yaron, he's projecting or speaking for objectivism, but it's essentially libertarianism as well. I call libertarians Republicans who smoke pot. To hell with everybody else, I got mine.
Yeah, that's actually an apt way to describe them. The other thing is, doctors take care of patients they don't like all the time. They have to, because of the Hippocratic Oath.
It's part of the job description.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well said. Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate the call. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy in our republic. We'll be right back.
And plenty's what it takes to get some health insurance in these old United States. I just know I shouldn't have to go bankrupt or on the street if the cancer comes a-calling, as it might for you or me. I ran into my congressman, said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C. So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you up right till the good Lord says that it's your day."
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. I think that the United States Supreme Court should rule that health care is a right in the United States. And if not, then Congress should pass a law saying it is our belief that health care is a right that is covered under the preamble of the Constitution. It falls into the category of the general welfare, and we will all participate in that. Lonnie in Eugene, Oregon, KOPT. Hey, Lonnie, what's up?
Hi, I had to respond to the Amerindian guy who said, as long as they don't hurt anybody, the big thing they miss is that they do hurt people. In gathering their wealth, a lot of the things that they own stock in harm people and the way they live. There's no corporate responsibility. A lot of the people that suffer on the planet, it's because the rich are getting richer at the backs of the poor, and this is why democracy responds to those needs. Basic health care is a non sequitur. Like, who wouldn't give? It only makes sense to keep the people at a bare minimum healthy so they can work for you.
In the most selfish of worlds. Good point. Lonnie, thank you very much, and well said. Dr. Gantz in Arcata, California, listening on KOPT. Hey, Dr. Gantz.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, thanks very much for your program. It's a breath of fresh air.
Thank you, sir.
Jay Davis from up here said that you discussed the plan with me. First, if I could, I'd like to make a comment or two about the caller from the Objectivist fellow. I didn't get his name. I've been
Aaron
a
Brooke.
For 40 years, and what he says is patently nonsense. Number one, our longevity is based as much on public health measures as it is on individual medication and individual disease control. And I'd like to know what he thinks about privatizing vaccinations for school children, water control, and things of that nature.
He would be in favor of it.
Then we could all run around dying of diarrhea before we're 5 years old.
Yep. But the rich wouldn't.
Well, the rich would, because viruses don't. You're not going to sit there and control them with a pile of money. And what are they going to do? Huddle behind high walls around Aspen, Colorado?
I think that's their theory. Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing is, he's. I don't know what he's going to privatize the body pickup off the streets. That's ridiculous. Furthermore, medicine is in effect a very poorly run universal health care system now. And by that I mean, if somebody without insurance gets desperately sick enough, they end up in an emergency room where we all pay for their health care in the most expensive way possible, in the most inefficient and ineffective way possible. But we don't just say to people when they come staggering into an emergency room, you don't have insurance, we're going to throw you out in the street. It's against the law not to render them emergency care.
Right.
If
we had rendered them preventative care in the first place,
of course,
they ended up in the emergency room, the $50 worth of annual checkup would have saved the $50,000 worth of emergency room.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. And finally, this whole argument from people about, socialist medicine, etc., is a false argument. It would be very easy to design a universal health care system in this country, if I may. The first thing you'd pass is a health insurance act. And what it would say is what every insurance, at a minimum, health insurance, must provide. Portability, da-da-da, and
list. This is what Ron Wyden is suggesting, by the way.
Yeah, and list the services. Okay, yeah. So you've got a universal...
But I'm saying, why even have the company? I mean, we have, in the United States right now, we have a socialized medicine system. It's called the Veterans Administration. They run hospitals. They work rather well. And we have a single-payer system, more like the socialized system, more like the British system, which I've used, and the single-payer system, more like the German system, which I used. I lived there for a year. And the single-payer system we have in the United States is called Medicare and Medicaid. The problem with all three of those systems right now in the United States, Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA hospital system, is that each one represents a small enough slice of the population that they don't achieve critical mass and therefore can't speak loudly enough that our elected representatives listen to them instead of to the lobbyists. If everybody in America had Medicare or Medicaid or was a member of the Veterans Administration hospital system, for example, if one of those three systems, a single-payer system or a socialized system, was in place, we would not have politicians dancing to the tune of health insurance companies that are sucking 20-30% of our health care dollars out so that William McGuire can make a $1.78 billion paycheck.
I agree with you 100%. If I could just finish, what I would do is pass a Universal Health Care Act saying this is the minimum that any health insurance must provide people. Second thing I would do is get rid of Medicaid and make Medicare available to everybody on a means-tested basis. Then I would say to the private insurance companies, you say you're more efficient than us, which is nonsense. You say that you're better than us, which is nonsense. Then go ahead and create a private insurance. However, you must provide all those things that are required in a Universal Health Care Act. And just like Medicare, we'll have to provide all those things.
Right,
and
so
if you can sell me insurance cheaper than the government, then I'll buy it. Otherwise, I'll get it from the government.
Yeah.
And we would have everybody insured, just as we have everybody insured with auto insurance.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely. Although auto insurance, again, is a mandated, unregulated monopoly.
Guys, the private insurance guys that say they're so much more efficient have nothing to complain about.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, the private insurance guys are more efficient. They can deliver health care for about 2.5% expense, whereas the federal government's about 3% expense. But that's not what they deliver it for. They deliver it for about 20% expense. Why? Because they have to pay multi-million dollar salaries to their CEOs. They got to pay for the gold-plated faucets in the bathrooms in their corporate jets. They got to pay for their corporate headquarters, for their marketing, for their detailment, for everything else out there. And it's crazy. Randy in Pennsylvania, driving in Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy. We're going to try this again, Randy?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. You're live and on the air.
Okay, Tom, I like your show, I like your politics, but the comment you made earlier about the distinction between Republican democracy being not important is not well-founded.
No, I wasn't saying that the distinction is not important. What I was saying is that Madison, in 1787, in Federalist Number 10, for the first time, created that distinction. And then later in his presidency pointed out that he had created that distinction. And although, you know, you could argue that there is a very real distinction, Madison in Federalist Number 10 says a democracy is like a mob rule, and we don't want to have that. And
right.
A republic is the rule of law, and we do want to have that. In reality, as he pointed out after he was president, what we have is both. We have a constitutionally limited democratic republic.
Right, right. Well, the distinction was founded more on the Athenian versus the Roman sort of models of government. And
right, in the Greek model, you had to have 6,001 people show up in order to pass law, because you had and you had people serving basically on a lottery system. It was like jury duty, and if you didn't serve and to be one of those 6,000, when your name was called, you were called an idiota. You know, if you didn't want to be part of the polis.
Well, right. But there's another element here you're missing. See, all the original political scientists, if you will, Aristotle, Polybius, and Cicero, and so forth. I'm an ancient historian, by the way, so I do this for a living.
Yeah.
But anyway,
they didn't like democracy. They,
none of them believed that any particular form of government was itself necessarily good or bad. But each good thing could turn to the bad, sort of the bad side. Democracy to mob rule, monarchy to tyranny, aristocracy to oligarchy, and so forth.
Right.
And what all of those three had in common, those three ancient historians I just mentioned, had in common is they believe that by mixing the three elements together that each could hold the other in check. And so the House represents the mob or the democracy, the Senate represents the aristocracy, and of course the President the monarch, and that each would keep the other in check.
Yeah, and the court representing the rule of law, the republic.
Right, but the notion of the mixed constitution has more to do with the bicameral House, the two different checks, the rich and the poor, as two distinct elements. I mean,
I'm absolutely with you, Randy, and I agree, and I think that we dance about, you know, we count the angels on the head of this pin at our peril here. But thank you for the clarification. I would like to get back to the healthcare aspect of this. Kim in Fort Myers, Florida. We have about a minute before we have to take a break. Kim, what's up?
Oh, yeah, I called because I was thinking that as far as socialized medicine goes, I think it's a great idea, but the problem is you don't have a structure. There's not a structure right now possible to even support it.
Sure there is.
When you're talking about there's not enough doctors, enough nurses, enough clinics.
Sure there
are. It takes 8 to 10 years to even become a doctor without even an internship.
We are providing for the medical needs of this country right now. Why not just change the way we pay for it?
Because even if you change the way you pay for it, you don't have enough people and infrastructure to even support it if you did that.
Well,
you're years and years away from...
Respectfully, I disagree, although I do think that, you know, the AMA purposely limiting the number of doctors who can graduate from medical schools in order to drive up the cost of the salaries of doctors is something that should be, you know, looked into, shall we say?
Yeah, I wondered about that myself. That happens in almost any of the professions, the lawyers, doctors, where they do limit the amount of people.
And frankly, I think it shouldn't. But, Kim, thanks for your call. Good to hear from you. We have to take a break here. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as Bush Sr. calls Portland, Oregon. We'll be back. And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. You can drop by our live chat room that I hang out in during the breaks. We are live 9 a.m. Noon to 3 Eastern time, 9 a.m. to noon Pacific time. And so if you're listening to us live, drop into our live chat room and say hi. Just go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It's right up at the top of the page. By the way, just a quick announcement. January 5th, I'll be doing my program, this program, live from our affiliate WPTT in Pittsburgh. And that evening, I'll be signing Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book, at Borders in Pittsburgh in the Monroeville location. The following day, on January 6th in Minneapolis, it's a Saturday, that afternoon, I'll be signing books at Magers and Quinn. We are carried in Minneapolis on the Air America affiliate there. I'm sorry, I don't have the call letter right in front of me. In Reno, Nevada, on January 12th through the 14th, there's going to be the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival is going to be playing. It's going to be screening Crude Impact, a documentary movie about the end of oil that has me in it and contains content from my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, about peak oil. And January 25th and 26th, I'll be doing this show live from Washington, D.C., the State of the Union, a radio row there set up at or near the White House, or the Congress. And on January 25th at 7:30 at the Mayflower Hotel, I'll be speaking on my book Screwed again. So that's the news. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Craig in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Craig, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I hope you're doing really well.
Thank you. I am.
I do. I sure do a lot.
And I hope the same for you. And happy, merry, merry.
Thanks. Merry whatever it is. I don't
there
care.
You go.
Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever.
Yeah. So what's up?
Well, I just, thinking about the libertarians that you call Republicans who smoke pot. And
they smoke pot and they want to get laid. I mean, libertarians basically say we shouldn't have laws against prostitution and we shouldn't have laws against drugs, but we also should not, as a society, participate in governing ourselves or protecting the weakest among us.
Exactly. Well, it just seems to me that that people like you and I, progressives, that we, at some point, we make a decision of what type of country we want to live in. Or the world, for that matter. And do we want to live in a world of sick people, a country of sick people, or in a country of healthy people who are able to work and contribute to society and make the machine run?
Right, absolutely. And by creating the infrastructure of community, which we call government, things like public education and public roads and public works, the physician or who called earlier talking about, public health system, making sure that our food supply is safe and all these kinds of things. We are, and creating a court system and a monitoring system that business can use. We are creating the infrastructure for corporations to operate, and we're also creating the infrastructure in which we can have a better world. Good point, Craig. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. Scott in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program. Scott is listening to his radio, not his telephone. Let's go to Mike in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you, Mike.
Either government is a filter to represent and redress grievances, or it's a blunt instrument to rationalize the acceptance of those grievances and repress those grievances. Person's health, whoever it is, it's a public safety issue. A person's got a disease, emotionally distraught, mentally deranged, or whatever. They're a threat to public safety. And these people who just say,
or a person who's contagious.
Yeah, drop dead on health care. those people are the ones that are going to get caught up the worst when, you know, we have a disease-ridden society.
Absolutely. I remember the first time I worked in India. I flew into Bombay, Mumbai, and then took a plane to Hyderabad. In fact, it was the week after that big earthquake that wiped out parts just north of Hyderabad. And I'm sitting here on the plane flying into Hyderabad. I'm reading the Indian Business News, which is the Indian version of Newsweek or Business Week. And there's an article about how over 300 million people in India are carrying tuberculosis. That's a third of the population. I land in Hyderabad, and I'm standing in the airport, you know, waiting for the next flight. And here's a guy honking over, you know, just coughing his lungs up into a wastebasket, and sort of like on a petri dish, the people form this giant circle around him. I mean, there's just a 30-foot radius that's completely empty around him because everybody realizes what's going on. This guy's blowing tuberculosis all over the waiting room, and everybody is like around the perimeter. And I'm thinking this. You know, this is a system that doesn't work. And that's exactly what you've identified, and you're spot on. I appreciate the comment, Mike. Thank you. Ken in Fort Lauderdale, we have just a minute before we have to wrap up this hour. We'll continue this conversation as we continue with the day. But, Ken, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. The Commonwealth is not served, and I trust you'd agree, by a system, a healthcare system, that allows Big Pharma to write off government-funded research as their own number one, and to allow them to advertise prescription drugs
and deduct it from their taxable income.
Absolutely.
Now, we are subsidizing. When you see an ad for a drug on TV, you and I are subsidizing that because that's a tax-deductible expense to that corporation.
It's disgusting, and more to the point, a ridiculous percentage, some 70% of their profits come from these advertised drugs, which are just basically reformulations of garbage we never needed to begin with. Thank you.
You're welcome, Ken. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you or I, as individuals, were to go out and buy an ad in the paper saying, you know, I believe this, you would have to pay taxes on the income that you used to buy that ad. But if a corporation does it, no, they don't have to pay taxes on the income. No problem. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour. We're going to be talking with Stuart Pym. Let's take this discussion even out into the larger picture of what are we doing, not just to the human race with our lack of health care. What are we doing to the planet with our lack of planetary consciousness? Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of By and For We the People of the United States of America, and of the world, for that matter. Our quote for the day from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Responsibility does not only lie with the leaders of our countries, or with those who have been appointed or elected to do a particular job. It lies with each of us individually. Peace, for example, starts within each of us. When we have inner peace, we can be at peace with those around us. Speaking of peace with those around us, we need to be giving some serious thought to declaring peace with all the rest of the species on Earth. The weekend before last, I believe, as I recall, maybe it was two weekends before last, I was honored to be invited to be part of a closed-door, sort of a think-tank weekend put on by the Praxis Peace Conference in San Francisco. And one of the participants with whom I spent the weekend, a man that I was blown away by, Stuart Pym. He's the Doris Duke Professor of Conservation Ecology at the Nicholas School of Environment and Earth Sciences, Duke University. And the author of The World According to Pym, numerous movies and books, and have been referenced his work or about him. Also, the author of a piece in Scientific American. Some amazing stuff here, and I just I said, you know, you've got to tell this story on the radio. Stuart Pym, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. It was wonderful to meet you a couple of weekends ago.
I have to say the work that you are doing is, in my opinion, among the most important in the world. Tell our listeners what briefly, please, the situation that we face as a human species.
I think the biggest environmental challenge that we face is loss of species. Many of your listeners have probably read in the last day or two that a wonderful, bizarre species of dolphin has disappeared from the Yangtze River in China.
Which was worshipped. It was called the goddess of the river.
Yes. I mean, a clearly a very, very unusual animal. The fact is that whenever we lose something big and charismatic like that, we are nearly always losing a lot of other things too. For the Yangtze River to become so bad, so polluted that it's lost a dolphin probably tells you that it's losing its fish and lots of other species as well. So the bad news is that we are probably now driving species to extinction 100, maybe even 1,000 times faster than they should go. Species have always gone extinct in the past. What is new now, we're driving species to extinction much faster.
And one of the statistics that I heard this last weekend a couple weekends ago when we were together was that within somewhere between 30 and 50 years from now, as many as half of all species on Earth may go extinct. First of all, is that accurate? And secondly, if we think of species as organs within the body of the planet, you know, the planet is a living organism. I mean, I would rather not, but I could do without one arm or even two arms, arguably. I could do without one kidney. I can do without one eye. But if I was to lose half of my body parts, I'm not sure I could survive.
It's a good analogy. And I think it comes to bear on the issue of the Yangtze River. It's probably a river that's very seriously ill. It may be, parts of it may be dead. The reason that we come up with numbers like that, and those numbers are indeed results of some of my work as well as many others, is that we know where the wild things are. We know that on land, that the tropical forests of the world hold most of the species. Our wetlands and our rivers hold a lot of species. In the oceans, our coral reefs are very rich. And we know that for those areas, both within our country and across the world, that those areas are being massively harmed by human actions.
Yeah. And what can we do about this?
Well, I mean, the good news is really that we can do a lot. The challenging news is that we have to do something soon, or else we're going to pass on to our children and grandchildren a very much poorer place than the
world. Dying world, basically.
A dying world. But, you know, there really are a lot of things that we can do.
I was very impressed by what you're doing. You're down in the rainforests of Brazil. You're actually, one of the things you're doing is organizing private foundations to buy up land in highly super, super sensitive areas where you have incredible biodiversity and it's being ripped apart by roads and logging and other things, buying up that land so that those species can survive.
That's one of the things that we do. We're looking for the most fragile places on the planet. And, you know, when you get there, you often find that there are wonderful local groups of people who, you know, sometimes can be very poor, but they're very passionate about their homes and they want to keep those special places. You know, we don't have to save everything. I'm not saying we have to go back to, you know, horse-drawn buggies and a world without electricity. But there are special parts of the planet, and if we act now to protect them, we can clearly make a huge difference to the heritage that we'll pass on to our children.
Yeah, and this is no small issue. Richard Leakey has referred to what is going on right now as the sixth extinction. There have been five times in the past when as much as 80-90% of all species on Earth have vanished. Major extinctions, mostly presumed to be the result of celestial events, you know, the Earth being hit by comets or asteroids or whatever,
yeah.
You know, meteors, or meteorites, I guess, if it hits the Earth. Are we in the midst of an extinction or are we facing an extinction?
Well, the notion of the sixth extinction is such a good one. I'm calling from Key West. I do a lot of work in the Florida Keys. I'm here teaching a field course at a botanic garden and patch of tropical forest here. you know, on the last day of the Cretaceous period, 65 million years ago, there would have been a massive collision with an asteroid that would have evaporated Yucatan just to the south of me, and, you know, where it happened today, there would be nothing left but a few molecules of carbon. The fact is that that cataclysmic event wiped out about as many species as we think we could lose on Earth over the next 100 years if we don't get our act together quickly.
Which dramatically transformed the world, at the very least.
It transformed the world for 10 million years.
Yeah, and who knows? I mean, maybe some species will come along that is better, more evolutionarily adapted than us, and our extinction will be, you know, in the grand scheme of things, in the million-year look, a good thing. But I'm not all excited about it, frankly.
No, I mean, I'm concerned about the things that we can know and we can feel and we can sense.
Amen.
Yeah, children,
amen.
Grandchildren, the people we can prevent these if we do a good job.
We're talking with Dr. Stuart Pym. Dr. Stuart Pym, tell my listeners, our listeners, the story that you told me about hearing the last bird. We have about 2 minutes left here.
Well, reading about the Bajie, this dolphin that's just disappeared from China, one of the people on that trip, Bob Pittman from Scripps Institute of Oceanography in San Diego, is a good friend of mine. I've sailed with Bob. And I have some sense of what Bob must feel like now, having spent 2 months sailing up and down the Yangtze River. I worked on the island of Maui and the Hawaiian Islands, looking for a species of bird. I spent months in the pouring cold rain of upland Maui, never saw it. That bird is gone. One of my friends saw the last bird of another species on the island of Kauai, played a tape of it just by mistake because he didn't really want to disturb the bird. The bird sang vigorously. It's a beautiful song. And the bird almost certainly thought, wow, there's another individual out there. And, of course, it was just a tape recording. When my friend went back a few weeks later, he played the tape and there was no answer. And there's that extraordinary sense of loss when you destroy species like that.
So that literally, your friend played the tape, the call, the mating call of one of the of this last bird. What was the species?
It's called the O-O-R-R.
Okay, so he played the tape of the O-O-R-R, and one of them replied, and now...
No reply anymore.
So the forest for the O-O-R-R, the world has gone black.
The world has gone silent.
Yeah. And we're facing the possibility that we could create a world that goes silent. How can people best do something about this? What resources do you recommend people check out? Is there a website? Is there a place? What's step one? Or do we just need to wake up everybody we possibly can?
I think we need to realize that we are changing the world, we are changing its climate, we are destroying our ecosystems. We need to become a much more aware of what we do. We need to be aware of what we buy, the coffees that we buy, the fish that we eat in the supermarket. We need to realize that we are part of the world, and we need to have a better sense of what we're doing to it.
Indeed. In fact, I think one of the most toxic stories that is the legacy of, arguably, of Aristotle, is that we are separate from the world and the world is a giant machine. And if we can just figure out the levers to pull, everything will be fine. It's not. The world is a living organism.
And we're part of it.
And we are part of it. We are living organisms, interpenetrated by it and interpenetrating it. Dr. Stuart Pym, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Good talking with you again. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of By and For We the People. We'll be right back.
The forests, we will surely meet our end. We should do business in an eco-friendly way, but that would cost too much, so all I've got to say is come on, come on, come on, come on.
Flash it!
Flash another little piece of the forest, baby. Down, baby. No need to worry,
more wood out there.
One of the other cool things about what Stuart Pym is doing, and not just him, there's a whole bunch of groups out there who are buying rainforest land to set it aside, or who are working with governments to protect rainforest land from poachers and you know, poaching loggers. A lot of them are poaching animals. Many of them are poaching the vegetation of the forest. Is that by locking up this forest land, we're also sequestering carbon. It's also taking carbon out of the atmosphere. Yes, it's not a long-term solution. A tree only holds carbon for a couple hundred years, and then when it rots, when it dies and it rots, carbon goes back into the atmosphere. But during that couple of hundred years, we are pulling carbon. We're talking about gigatons, millions, billions of tons of carbon out of the atmosphere. As a consequence of trying to conserve our forests, there's a huge room to do that. Anyhow, welcome back. 23 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where despair is not an option. On this day in history, 8 years ago, December 19th, 1998, Tom DeLay stood up and said, "This nation sits at a crossroads. One direction points to the higher road of the rule of law, sometimes hard, unpleasant. This path relies on truth, justice, and the rigorous application of the principle that no man is above the law. Now, the other road is the path of least resistance. This is where we start making exceptions to our laws based on poll numbers and spin control. This is when we pitch the law completely overboard, when the mood fits us, when we ignore the facts in order to cover up the truth. No man is above the law, and no man is below the law. That's the principle we all hold very dear in this country." Tom DeLay speaking as he delivered articles of impeachment, or as the House of Representatives voted to sustain two of the four articles of impeachment against William Jefferson Clinton. On this day in history, Bill Clinton was impeached. 67% approval rating. Republicans were offered an opportunity to simply censure him. The Democrats would have gone along with it. No, they wanted to remove him from office. By the way, just ironically, a couple of weeks before the impeachment, the guy who was leading it, Newt Gingrich, he had to suddenly resign his seat because it was going to come out that he was having a sexual relationship with a younger woman from a House colleague's staff. And then the day of the impeachment, today, 8 years ago, the guy that Newt handed the impeachment off to, Robert Livingston, the congressman from Louisiana, he had to submit submitted his resignation because Larry Flynt had found several women who had come forward and said and had proof that they were having sexual relationships with Livingston, who was married, who was impeaching Bill Clinton for having sex while being, you know, outside of his marriage, for lying about having sex outside of his marriage when he was married. So I guess the question for the day, illegally wiretapping American citizens, torture, secret prisons, lying about war, is it more or less important than lying about a little nookie in the White House? I just tossed that out there. But back to health care. Where are we going to go? What's the future of this country? What direction are we going? I know the Republicans would like us to be talking about the war on Christmas. I think, frankly, it's more important that we be talking about the fact that we've got people among us who are dying. The federal government itself estimates around 18,000 people a year die, Congressional Budget Office, as a consequence of not having health insurance. Harry in Evergreen, Colorado. Hey, Harry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show. Sure. You mentioned earlier that you thought that the private health care insurance cost about 20% or so in terms of overhead.
Well, it varies, actually. The Wall Street Journal did a big expose on this about a year ago, and I just flogged it mercilessly on this show because they actually did some very good reporting. And what they found was that some health insurance companies were able to deliver health care for overhead as little as 13% to 18%. Others were running as high as 40% and 50%. The average was, as I recall, was around 24%, 25%.
Well, I think everybody who's showing those lower numbers is cooking their books like Enron and Halliburton.
Probably you're right. Probably.
I can tell you how. I'm a psychologist. I've been in private practice for over 30 years. And one of the things that I'm very passionate about is the need for mental health care being treated on an equal basis.
I agree. The brain is part of the body, and the mind is part of us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Changed. And one of the things that many of these companies do is they have what's called carve-outs. So instead of the main parent company handling the mental health care, they subcontract that out to another company.
And that way they maintain their profitability and create nonprofit center or loss centers like Enron did with all their phony companies.
Well, right.
Amazing. Well, Harry, we've got to take a break. I'm sorry, it's a hard break at the bottom of the hour, but I appreciate the comment. Well said. And thank you very much for listening and calling in. 27 minutes past the hour on the place where smart people get their news.
Welcome to George Bush National Park, where the air smells just like diesel. And there ain't no animals left around here except snakes, skunks, rats, and weasels. Now we ain't got no waterfalls or rivers. This environment of stuff gives us a shiver. And we don't need Yellowstone or Carlsbad Heaven. 'Cause all the wildlife we need is in the tavern.
Yes, welcome back to the George W. Bush National Park. Welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio. That is supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Particularly, listen for the ads from our local affiliates, the local station that you're listening to. Listen for those advertisers. Let them know that you're listening. Patronize their products. As well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, get your latest iPods and all things Macintosh at smalldog.com, and the organic wine company, ecowine.com. Joe Republican gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and this, John Gray wrote this, credit where credit's due. Joe Republican gets up at 6 in the morning, fills his coffee pot with water, prepares his morning coffee. The water is clean and good because some tree-hugging liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. With his first swallow of coffee, he takes his daily medication. His medications are safe to take because some stupid commie liberal fought to ensure their safety and that they work as advertised. All but $10 of Joe's medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employees for paid medical insurance, and Joe gets it too. He prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs. He knows that his bacon doesn't have trichinomiasis because some girly man liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. In his morning shower, he reaches for his shampoo. His bottle is properly labeled because some crybaby liberal fought for his right to know what was in his, what he was putting on his body and how much it contained. He dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some environmentalist wacko liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks to a subway station for his government-subsidized ride to work. Saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees because some fancy-pants liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the opportunity to contribute to society. Joe begins his workday. He has a good job with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation because some lazy liberal union members fought and died for those working standards. If Joe's hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get workers' compensation or an unemployment check because some stupid liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of a temporary misfortune. In time, and Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay some bills. Joe's deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some godless liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system in the before the Republican Great Depression. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some elitist liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he and others of us were educated and thus earned more money over his lifetime. After work this evening, he plans to visit his father at the farm out in the country. Gets in his car for the drive. His car is among the safest in the world because some American-hating liberal fought for car safety standards. He arrives at his boyhood home. He's the third generation to live in a house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because banks didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Joe is happy to see his father, who's now retired and living on Social Security and a union pension, because some wine-drinking, cheese-eating liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. Joe gets back in his car for the ride home and turns on a talk radio show. The host keeps saying, liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't mention that the beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout the day. Joe agrees. As he hears Rush say,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Joe agrees. He says, we don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man and who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. See, that's the major cleavage. Are we going to be a liberal nation, as George Washington, who the first president to call himself a liberal, said, I hope America shall ever be at the forefront of liberality, a nation that believes in community, that believes that we're all in it together, that believes that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link? Or are we going to be a selfish, libertarian, conservative society that believes that the value of society is defined by who's the richest among us? That really and truly is the cleavage. And conservatives, you know, will be right up, honest conservatives will tell you that. And I just happen to fall on the George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all the way through liberals like Dwight Eisenhower and Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson side. And I realize that there are a lot of conservatives out there who are with Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush and believing that, you know, really we should end welfare as we know it and we should do away with government programs and to hell with the social safety net. Gina in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Gina, thanks for waiting so long. What's up?
Hey, thank you for my daily dose of sanity. I don't know what I'm going to do when you go back to your night time slot when I can't stay awake. I'm going to go into withdrawal.
Oh, I do this show. I mean, this is the time I've been doing the show for 3.5 years. It's up to the local station. Well, let's not even get into that.
Okay, so, I just want to tell you thank you for my sanity, because I used
you're
to
welcome.
Think I was just paranoid.
Thank you.
Anyway, I heard a Dr. Fred Bell talking about the SSRI version of what the healthcare industry is promoting, antidepressants to 30% of the population.
Yeah, SSRIs, for people who don't know, are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. It's a class of drugs that, by reducing the rate at which the neurochemical serotonin in the brain is recycled or is used up, increases the overall level of serotonin. Serotonin is usually associated with feeling of well-being. In fact, you can actually measurably raise your blood serotonin levels simply by lifting the corners of your mouth and holding them there for about a minute.
That's
amazing.
Horrible.
Seriously.
Well, listen.
But anyway, so you were saying. SSRI drugs are like Prozac, for example, is an SSRI drug.
Well, the thing that scared me that I wanted to share is an ingredient in them called cyclohexane, which is also found in angel dust, which triggers a brain frequency in the back brain, the cerebellum, which controls our animal functions.
Right.
In other words,
yeah.
It's a primitive mode frequency that kicks in the brain when you take this drug, and it makes you more programmable.
Oh, that's interesting. I have to confess, I've written several books on psychology and psychiatry, and I used to be rostered by the state of Vermont as a psychotherapist, but I don't pretend to be an expert on pharmacology, psychopharmacology, and you're beyond my level of expertise.
I just wanted to throw that out there, too.
That's interesting.
I knew you could do something with this.
Yeah, well, I'll poke around and look at it. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. It's good to hear from you. Amy in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, all right, I've got a comment about health care.
Yes.
And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the uninsured and the underinsured. And I think we need to broaden the conversation to include a third category called the falsely insured. Which is most of us.
Did you know that half of all bankruptcies in the United States are the consequence of people getting ill, and that half of the people who get ill and have to declare bankruptcy have full health insurance?
Yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about, okay? I'm talking about the way that insurance policies are written and the fine print that allows an insurance company to deny benefits the minute something expensive comes up.
Right. In other words, somebody gets diabetes, somebody discovers that they have Hep C, somebody gets glaucoma, whatever, something like that.
Or there's a woman in New Jersey who has spent 7 years trying to get the state to honor giving hearing aids to children with major hearing loss. The insurance companies in New Jersey will provide diagnostic services, will provide speech therapy services, will not provide hearing aids.
Amy, excellent point and well made. We need to, this is why this is an industry crying out for regulation. Frankly, it's an industry that I think should simply be set aside. We should simply say, as most of the other countries in the world have, sorry, we don't need no stinking health insurance companies. We have Medicare. We have health insurance for all. And let the guys with the green eye shades, those boring civil servants who are getting their boring civil service pay with their boring benefits and pension, let them take care of it like they have with Social Security. Social Security has never failed to write a check. Richard in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Richard, we have about a minute before we have to take a break. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Good to talk to you. I have a kind of ongoing fight going with libertarians here in Portland all the time. One of the things that I would suggest is that people that have that kind of problem might want to go to Robert Kuttner's excellent book, Everything for Sale.
Yes.
The Virtues and Limits of Markets. One of the things that's true about the health market in particular is that it is not a typical market. And because it's not a typical market, trying to make it more like a real market by deregulation, it actually makes it worse.
Yes. Well, and beyond that, I mean, that's true with healthcare, but with markets in general, I mean, the big argument that you can get into with libertarians and conservatives is that markets in general don't deal with externalities.
Exactly.
The whole goal is to externalize, if you're creating a pollution, for example, gallon of gasoline should be, the real cost to society of gasoline is about $10 a gallon, because about $6 a gallon right now represents the cost of all the cancers that are caused by people inhaling gas fumes, all the asthma that's caused by gasoline fumes, and the damage to the environment. And those externalities are not being paid by anybody except us. 45 minutes past the hour.
Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Pilgrims in the parking lot, arteries clogged with blood clots, pushing through the aisles of department stores. Neon crosses and Christmas lights, credit card debts and brand new bikes. The holidays are here and we're still at war.
Yeah, the holidays are here and we're still at war. Happy, happy, merry, merry. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here on the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Victoria Jones with us on Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Victoria, we've been discussing health care. Got a couple of callers who would still like to make a few points on it. So how about I ask you what's going on in Washington, D.C. and give me a quick update, and then together you and I can take some calls.
Okay. Two things really going on in Washington, D.C. One is the press is up in arms over the fact that we were not informed about Mrs. Bush's skin cancer. We're told that it was either that it was medical privacy or that it was no big deal. When I pressed Tony Snow on which was it then, it has to be one or the other, he seemed to be unable to tell me.
Why can't it be both?
He seemed to be unable to tell me if it was both.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I just think that that's... I mean, a member of my family had the exact same cancer and just doesn't like to talk about it. I think that there's...
And which is fair enough. Our concern, really, as members of the press, was that this is potentially part of a pattern of the Bush administration not giving out information.
Yes, and that's a good point. Yes.
The other thing, of course, is this apparent rift between the chairman or between the Joint Chiefs and the Bush administration over the surge that the Bush administration plans in Iraq. There was a great deal of talk about that at the press briefing today.
Do we know that they're actually planning it?
He would not confirm that it's being planned. He would confirm that it is being discussed along with a lot of other options.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
As far as he would go, but he would not admit that there was any kind of rift.
Yeah, but when the Joint Chiefs start leaking to the media, then you know that Mr. Gates is stepping into a beehive, or I don't know what the appropriate metaphor is here, but there's...
Well, beehive sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, he's stepping into a real mess. It's going to be a tough one. Let's take a few calls here. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois, listening on WINI, one of our very first affiliates. We've been on the air there about a little over three years, I think. And locally owned, Dale and Nancy doing a great job. Dale even took me to task one day for one of our bumper music. I just love it working with independently owned stations. Hey, Paula.
Hi. Sorry, this isn't for Victoria Jones. This is a plug for Universal Healthcare just in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
2 years ago, they passed a Healthcare Justice Act, and I've been going to these meetings ever since, very boring meetings, once a month for the Campaign for Better Healthcare, which all along has been for single payer. In November, they announced that, they just couldn't get a consensus with single payer, so they're going to go along with the force every business and every person in Illinois to buy insurance from private companies.
Right, otherwise known as the Health Insurance Corporation Subsidy Act.
Exactly. So what I want to say is there's a Physicians for Better Healthcare, Physicians for a National Health Program is setting up a counter thing to push, and they're finding a senator in Illinois who's going to introduce this bill. And if anyone's interested, we are going to have a man come down and talk in Carbondale in February, and the website, can I give the website?
Sure.
www.pnhp, that stands for Physicians for National Health Program, pnhp.org/ILCoalition.
Right, or you could just go to their homepage. I was the keynote speaker at the Physicians for National Health Program's annual convention 3 years ago, maybe
Excellent.
4 years ago, in San Francisco, and went out, in fact, with a friend of ours from Vermont who's a physician. And, it's an amazing group, of docs, mostly, and they're doing some really good work. Paula, thanks for the heads up on that.
Okay, I hope everyone in Illinois pays attention.
Indeed. Everyone all around the country, that's the question. Victoria Jones, Ron Wyden has introduced this legislation that's going to make health care basically available to everybody in the United States. Any sense of how this is being received by, it's not, as far as I'd go, I mean, it's not a single-payer plan, but it is universal health coverage. What kind of response is it getting in Washington, D.C.?
It'll get a cautious response in Washington, D.C. as lawmakers try to see whether there's some way that they can support it because they know that their constituents want it, but Republicans are going to try and look at it and see if they can support it without being labeled socialist by the far right.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to try and look at.
Yeah, and good luck on that. David in Cambridge, Minnesota, you're live with me and with Victoria Jones. Hey, David.
How you doing? I'm good to talk to you, Tom.
Thank you.
Tom, let's talk about medical fraud.
Okay, we have about a minute and a half before we have to wrap up the show. So,
okay, we can get rid of $9 billion of medical fraud tomorrow morning by outlawing cholesterol-lowering drugs.
Really?
I'm a researcher, and I've never found one study that shows that cholesterol causes heart disease.
Yeah, I've heard that. The cholesterol is actually a symptom of inflammation. It's the body's response to inflammation.
There you go. In other words, you have heart disease first, the cholesterol comes in second.
Right, and the inflammation is what's causing the heart disease.
Exactly.
And in fact, there's a correlation between gum disease and heart disease.
Except because of inflammation in the gums.
That's right, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what happens is the reason that's... the latest drugs, what do they call, statin drugs?
Statins, yeah.
The reason the latest drugs are actually showing that people are living a little longer is they are anti-inflammatory, too.
Right. In other words, if you took aspirin, you'd get the same result.
Well, I wouldn't take aspirin because you increase your hemorrhagic strokes
in
the brain.
Right. So the thing is to get rid of the inflammation.
Exactly. But yeah. But you can take, say, Boswellia, which is $7, and it comes from the rainforest. And, of course, you know, as you know yourself, if we harvest the rainforest, we don't have to cut them down.
Yeah, or Schisandra or Silymarin, milk thistle. I mean, there's a lot of anti-inflammatories out there.
There you are. Well, you know. Lots of them. Ginger.
Yeah. White willow bark.
White willow bark. There you go. Where aspirin came from.
That's right. It contains acetic acid, the original. In fact, when they developed aspirin, they were trying to replicate white willow bark. Hey, Victoria, any final thoughts on all this?
Way above my pay grade.
Well, I sure appreciate your checking in with us on our daily report from Washington, D.C., and thanks for taking a few calls.
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service. 56 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with you after the news at the top of the hour. By the way, I wanted to get in as well on the topics we've been talking about. We'll carry on, but also there's some really fascinating economic news in today's Wall Street Journal, threats to the oil supply. But the biggest one is what's happening with the Democratic Party and their agenda and their future. We'll talk about that right after the news. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Telling the truth that multinational corporations would rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. The broadest measure of U.S. trade gap shows widening. This is from today's Wall Street Journal, an article by Greg Hitt. No pun intended. But America's taking a hit here. The broadest measure of the nation's trade deficit widened in the third quarter, with a shortfall in payments on foreign debt and investments increasing to a potentially worrisome high. Let me translate that into English for you. It's two things. The what's called the balance of payments includes the trade gap and the investment gap. Say it again, Alex. The trade gap is the difference between what we buy from the rest of the world and what we sell to the rest of the world. And when we buy from the rest of the world a whole lot more stuff than we sell to the rest of the world, we end up basically having to borrow money from the rest of the world or in order to buy all this stuff, or the rest of the world ending up with a whole bunch of dollars. And where are they going to spend those dollars? Here. But we don't make anything that they want to buy anymore. We're not an industrial powerhouse anymore. Ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on the American middle class in 1981 and began this whole process of radical transformation of our trade policies after 200 years of a tariff-based trade policy that protected domestic industries, American industries, Ronald Reagan and then Bush after him and then Clinton after him and then Bush after him have been systematically and rapidly deconstructing those barriers, sure, I'll use their language, those barriers that have kept in the United States American jobs and American companies. So what happens is we buy all this stuff from China and the rest of the world, oil from Saudi Arabia, cheap stuff from China. The oil from Saudi Arabia, of course, we wouldn't be buying if we had simply paid attention to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter back in 1978, just before Reagan came in. Carter just, he just laid it out. July 15th, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And he actually put into place policies that would make that happen. If those had stayed in place, if Reagan hadn't come in a year later and ripped the guts out of that thing along with the Republican Congress by 1994 during Clinton, if Reagan and the Republicans hadn't ripped the guts out of what Carter had put in place, we would not now be in the Middle East, because we would be importing a fraction of what we're importing. In fact, we would be importing so little oil we could say to Saudi Arabia and everybody else in the Middle East, see you later, guys. We can get enough just from Canada and Mexico. In fact, we may not even need that, because Carter took it a step further in 1979 when he said,
moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
And it would have. And so Reagan comes in, riding in on all this oil industry money, which has basically been running the White House ever since. Reagan comes riding in on all this oil industry money and takes down the solar panels on the roof of the White House and stops the whole, you know, let's wear sweaters in the White House and turn down the thermostats and says, hey, it's party time. We are the city on the hill. We need to behave like it. We need to behave like kings and queens. We're going to recreate Camelot here. To hell with the consequences. Future generations can pay, not us. And so what we did was we set up a situation. What Reagan set up in that regard, with regard to energy, was a situation where here now, 26 years later, we're spending a massive amount of money buying energy from countries overseas. Canada, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, other Gulf states, Iran, Iraq, and having to fight wars in the Middle East to protect that because it's now become strategic, right? Our military needs it to operate. Another article in today's Wall Street Journal, in fact, a rather long one. I'll just refer you to it rather than giving you details from it. It's right on the front page. As threats to oil supply grow, a general says U.S. isn't ready. Wald, now retired, seeks help from allies in defending the Caspian line and the African coast, pondering a doomsday scenario. And they basically lay it out. We're so dependent on imported oil that our military could get shut down if our oil supply was shut down in just three or four countries. That's how vulnerable we are. So number one, Reagan set it up by reversing Carter's policies on energy independence. Set it up that we would be buying from the rest of the world and just hundreds of billions of dollars a year worth of oil and other energy sources, gas as well, but primarily oil, number one. And number two, he started putting it into place and arguing for this whole fast-tracked authority, let the president have authority for trade bills. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Constitution gives Congress the authority for trade and for treaties with other countries. And so what Reagan was arguing for and Bush Sr. was arguing for and Bill Clinton asked for and Bush Jr. has right now, it expires during this next Congress, by the way, is this so-called fast-track authority. And these were not the first guys. Nixon actually was the first, I think, to ask for it. But in any case, fast-track authority, where the president can say, you know, instead of Congress negotiating this deal, I'm going to negotiate it, and I'll just submit it to Congress for an up or down vote. They can't amend it. And Congress would have to pass a law taking away from themselves the power to negotiate trade deals and giving it to the president. And they have. That's what the Republicans did when they took control of Congress. And so the president was able to negotiate these fast-track deals and grant, you know, permanent normal trade relations status to countries like China who are still torturing and murdering people. And the consequence of that was that not only are we shipping out of the United States hundreds of billions of dollars a year to import oil, we're also shipping out of the United States hundreds of billions of dollars a year to import junk from China, the computers from Taiwan, from Korea, through Japan, stuff from all over the world. We are importing. When Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, when he was sworn into office, as he put his hand on the Bible and the hostages were released in Iran, as in my opinion, as a result of a deal that Bush Sr. and William Casey cut with the Iranians to deny Jimmy Carter the election. Carter, you'll recall, was 6-8 points ahead of in the polls 3 months out. Everybody thought that Carter was going to easily beat Ronald Reagan because Reagan was a right-wing crackpot. Even his vice presidential candidate, George Herbert Walker Bush, said he was. Called it voodoo economics. But then there were those hostages. And for some reason, the Iranians just kept them and kept them and kept them and released them literally to the minute when Reagan took his oath of office. And then a couple of years later, Ollie North and all these guys, they're giving weapons to the Iranians? Why would they do that? Why is the administration doing it? Well, in any case, that's ancient history. But the point is that starting with Reagan and his war against the American middle class, his war against the middle class on behalf of multinational corporations, we find ourselves in a position where we are importing all this stuff and exporting dollars. What do those people in those other countries do with those dollars? They come back here and they buy our country. And so we no longer own ourselves. Since 1980, since Reagan, 13,730 companies in the United States have been sold to foreigners or foreign corporations for a total of $1,697,443,000,000. 90% of our footwear is made overseas. 87% of our audio and video equipment. 86% of our leather products. 67% of our apparel accessories. It just goes on and on and on. Our metal ore mining industries in the United States are 65% foreign owned. Our sound recording industries, 97% foreign owned. Our commodity contracts deal. You think commodity, you know, oil and wheat and pork bellies. The whole dealing business, 79% foreign owned, of us buying from us. So anyhow, in today's Wall Street Journal, they point out that the gap, the amount of money that is going out of the United States in exchange for all that stuff coming in, the oil that we're bringing in from the Middle East and the junk that we're bringing in from China, has reached such a high level that it is, quote, increasing to a potentially worrisome high. The story wraps up quoting the chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics Limited. He says the U.S. is now a hefty net external debtor, and the income flows will continue to deteriorate. When Reagan came into office, we were the largest creditor in the world. We are now the largest debtor. When Reagan came in, we were the largest manufacturer in the world. We are now the largest importer of manufactured goods. 16 minutes past the hour.
To Tom Hartman on the Al Franken Show here on Air America Radio.
Out there, without care, yeah, I was out of touch. But it wasn't because I didn't know enough. I just knew too much. Does that make me crazy?
No, not at all. Talk about fair and slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. The place for being progressive never felt so good. Here's the scary thing. In this relatively obscure article, I mean, it wasn't like buried in the back of the Wall Street Journal. I've already cut it out now. I'm not sure what page it was on, but it's in the front section. The headline is Broadest Measure of U.S. Trade Gap Shows Widening by Greg Hidd. The scary thing in here is he's talking about how while we have become a net debtor nation, Reaganomics, 26 years of conservative economic policies through four administrations, have not only, and I'm not talking about the internal debt, I mean, that's a whole other rant, right, and a huge one. You and I, each one of us, you owe $28,681.12 as of this moment. That's your share of our $8,662,474,440 debt. This is separate from that. That's just the money, the $8 trillion that Reagan and Bush and, to some extent, Clinton, although to his credit he tried to fix it, and Bush Jr. have borrowed. All but about $1 trillion of it, which was there when Reagan came into office. That $8.6 trillion debt is just the money that they borrowed to spend to make the economy look good. Yeah, that's a whole separate thing. What I'm talking about is our buying stuff from the rest of the world as a result of Reaganomics, these crazy trade policies that were first promoted by Reagan and that were embraced by Clinton. Number one. And the corollary to that, the other piece of that, that we have gone, as a consequence of that, we have gone from being a net manufacturer of goods that we sell to the rest of the world. The largest, when Reagan came into office, we were the largest manufacturer in the world of finished products and the largest importer in the world of raw materials. We brought iron ore into the United States. We shipped computers and TVs and cars out of the United States. Largest in the world when Reagan came into office. Today, it has completely reversed. We now export more raw materials than any other country in the world. In other words, the rest of the world is strip mining us. Our lumber, our ores, our mineral ores, even our trash, actually, is being sold. You know, recycled paper and things. They're shipping that stuff to China, and it's coming back to us in the boxes that our computers are coming in. So we are the world's largest exporter of raw materials.
and we are now the world's largest importer of finished goods. We have gone from the definition of a first world nation to the definition of a third world nation. That's what 26 years of conservative economic policies have brought us, number one, or trade policies, number one. And number two, as a consequence of that, because we are so in debt, the way that other countries and other and people in other countries who are ending up with all our money because we bought stuff from them, what they've been doing is they've been coming here and they've been buying our land, they've been buying our buildings, they've been buying Rockefeller Center, they bought Chrysler, they bought, you know, and the list goes on and on and on, right? They've been buying us, buying our companies, buying our apartment buildings. Now they're even buying, I mean, you've got a Spanish company that just bought a freeway from the state of Indiana. I mean, the states have been reduced because of all this so-called conservative pressure to cut corporate taxes. Corporations paying such a small percentage of the tax load now. The states can't afford to operate. They're selling off their highways to private corporations in Spain. Well, that has, for 26 years now, the way that they've been able to maintain the illusion of the America still being America is that other countries and other people in other countries have been willing to invest in America. In other words, buy us. But here's where it gets scary. And we've, you know, we've had foreign overseas investments, and we've been making a profit on our overseas investments that has been greater than the profit that people who have, like, you know, Toyota having factories in the United States, the profit that they take out of the country. Here's where it gets scary. From the article in the Wall Street Journal, the U.S., for the fourth consecutive quarter, see, the chickens are coming home to roost now, also paid out more to foreign creditors and investors than it received from its own investments abroad. This is called the investment deficit. And Greg Hitt points out in the Wall Street Journal, he says, until fairly recently, the nation's investment balance attracted little attention. The U.S. generally ran a surplus in that area, reflecting its sizable and profitable business investments abroad. And I would add the fact that we had a lot of businesses and a lot of land that foreigners wanted to buy. Well, now they've pretty much bought us all up. Okay, back to the article from the Wall Street Journal. But after years of financing its trade deficit by selling bonds and other assets to foreigners, other assets like $1.7 trillion worth of businesses, the U.S. now pays more to its foreign creditors than it receives in returns on its own foreign holdings. You get this? This is like for a family. First, we started living on our credit cards. That was the original Reaganomics. Give me a credit card with a $10 million line of credit, and I can show you what it looks like to look like I'm living large. People will look at that, and they say, boy, that guy's living large. Then we maxed out our credit cards, and we started selling off our house. Now we have sold off our house, and we've maxed out our credit cards. And as Ian Shepherdson, chief U.S. economist and forecasting firm High Frequency Economics, says, today's Wall Street Journal, the U.S. is now a hefty net external debtor, and the income flows will continue to deteriorate. This is an ominous sign for the nation's economy. 27 minutes past the hour.
Knows it better than I know myself, so I'm gonna let her do all the talking. Ooh. Ooh. I came across a place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree.
And welcome back. Tom Harbin here. We're helping you win the water cooler wars. 34 minutes past the hour.
We're going to go to your calls in just a moment. Our number 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, which is where I've been hanging out during the breaks here, just go over to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, it'll get you there. And click live chat. It's right up at the top of the page. And say hi. But right now, first, before we continue this conversation and get into what this has to do with the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton and everybody else, let's just take a quick look at what's going on. With the ongoing occupation, no, it's not a war. The war was over when George Bush declared it was over on May 1st. Yes, we took down a government. We occupied we deposed a government. We took their buildings. We killed their army. We won the war. What's going on with the ongoing occupation of Iraq?
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the thousands. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq as of 07:30 GMT on Tuesday, this from Reuters. Dateline Baqaba, a total of 12 bodies, including two women, were found in different parts of the religiously mixed city of Baqaba. In Mosul, the bodies of four people were found on Monday in different parts of that city. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb in a popular market wounded four people in the Zafarania district in the southern outskirts of Baghdad. In Rashid, three mortar rounds landed in a residential district, killing one and wounding three others. In Baghdad, gunmen, including some wearing police uniforms, stole at least 1.25 billion dinars, Iraqi currency. It's worth about $875,000. A police source said the gunmen took the money from industry ministry employees who were picking up money for salaries from a bank. An Interior Ministry source said the gunman stormed the bank itself and took as much as $1.4 million. Also, I mean, this is almost weird beyond belief. Also in Iraq, there's a new TV station. An article about it over in the Los Angeles Times today. The men with laptops sat around an unadorned conference table, chatted amicably about their plans and operations. The scene on the newly launched Al Zawara satellite television channel could have been footage from the boardroom of any company, if it weren't for the ski masks the men wore and the subject of the meeting, future mortar attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq. The renegade pro-insurgent Al Zawara channel, with a 24-hour diet of propaganda against U.S. forces and the Iraqi government, has become something of a sensation throughout the country. Many hours of the day, it plays footage of U.S. soldiers in Iraq being shot and blown up in insurgent attacks, often with religious chants or Saddam Hussein-era nationalist anthems in the background. Amazing. Oh, and also Hillary Clinton has come out and said that she would not have voted for the war, for the Iraq war, if she had known then what she knows now. And this, you know, a lot of people are going, oh, geez, she's flip-flopping, whatnot. I'm telling you, it's all about the parade. The parade got so big that Hillary had to join. And I think that's a good thing. That's why I said, you know, if Hillary ends up the Democratic nominee, I'll vote for her. Because I believe that it's all about the parade. It's not the people. It's not the leaders. It's not who you have in office. It's how many of us are out there speaking up. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Free in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Free, what's up?
Hi, a little tiny item I heard on Democracy Now! A few months ago. It seems really important to me that the M3 money supply is no longer going to be made public.
Actually, they stopped publishing M3 in March of this year, about, 6 months ago? And for the listeners who don't know what M3 is, it's the rate at which the government is basically manufacturing money out of thin air. And so they stopped publishing that. And then today we get this story, this from the Agence France-Presse. U.S. inflation made a surprise comeback in November with a surprising 2.0% rise in wholesale prices, the biggest monthly jump in 30 years. Now, 2% increase in 1 month is a 24% annual increase. And what is inflation? It's the consequence of printing more dollars than you need. And I'm of the opinion that the only way that the conservatives can get us out of the mess that they got us into by borrowing $8.6 trillion and creating this huge trade deficit on top of that, which is trillions of dollars in addition, is by reducing the value of the American currency to the point where they can pay off debts with cheaper dollars. I mean, this is what the Weimar Republic did in the 1920s in Germany. After they lost World War I, the Treaty of Versailles said that Germany had to pay back all the European countries for all the damage they caused, and it was denominated in Deutschmarks. They said you have to pay this country, you know, 1.7 billion Deutschmarks to France and 1.9 billion Deutschmarks to Belgium, and, you know, I don't know what the amounts were, but for example. And so the Germans said, that's cool. We'll just run the printing presses like crazy all day long to the point where 1.7 billion Deutschmarks is enough to buy a loaf of bread, and then say to France, here you are. Here's your 1.7 billion Deutschmarks, which is what they did, by the way. The problem is that it wiped out the German economy and it set up the rise of Hitler. Am I making sense, Free?
No, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Yeah, I think you mean yes. Because that's the problem. I mean, that's where all this stuff is going. David in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Say, I had a question about trade policy. If we were to institute the the kind of protectionist tariffs. I've heard you talk a lot about how that would benefit the middle class in our country. I'm just curious about how that would affect the working people in the affected countries on the other end, say, for example, India and China.
Sure. Well, first of all, we already have tariffs. I spent a good chunk of Saturday poking around on, in fact, I registered on, there's a government website where you can register and you can get into the, drill into the tariff tables. And they're like super micro. I mean, you know, like the tariff on rolled steel is different from the tariff on tube steel, which is different on the tariff on tube steel that's used to make pipes, which is different. So we have literally tens of thousands of tariffs. You know, scheduled tariffs. Typically, they're 1%, 2%, 3%. Some of them are 20, 30, 40, 50%. Some of them are fairly high. So, number one, we already have tariffs. What the problem is that we have been wiping out the tariffs on the big items that create an industrial infrastructure. And other countries have been maintaining their tariffs on those things. As I said, you know, I think yesterday or the day before, if General Motors wants to sell a car in China, they have to pay China a 20% import tax, a tariff. If China wants to sell a car in the United States, our import tariff is 2%. So there's a little bit of a difference. The argument that is put forward by the Tom Friedman folks is the one that you just laid out, David, as well. If we slow down the rate at which we are buying stuff from other countries, then those factories are going to go away and those people are going to be unemployed. And it's an argument that fundamentally doesn't hold water, because over time what we're doing is we're setting up a situation that's going to crash and burn anyway. I mean, the time is going to come when we can no longer borrow any more money, and where we have sold off all of our natural resources and all of our highways and all of our infrastructure and sold off, you know, Yellowstone and everything else, and we just can't buy from them anymore. In fact, what China is doing right now is they're starting to put up tariffs on the export of stuff mostly on the import of things, in order to protect their domestic industries so that their factories that are being built with our purchasing power, those factories will then start selling into the Chinese market. So, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, going back to Adam Smith in 1776, if you have one country that has a naturally, you know, their climate inclines well to grapes, so they make good wine, and another climate another country that makes good cheese, and another country that makes good wool for sweaters. You want those three countries to trade. We want to have trade so that we can all have wine, cheese, and sweaters. But if two of those countries are competing for wine, then it makes sense for them to both, at a certain small level, protect their domestic wine industry so that they continue to have one. I'm not suggesting we shut off trade with the rest of the world. I'm not even suggesting that we radically reduce it. I'm suggesting that we start being smart and strategic about it and start having a national discussion about what industries do we want to have stay in the United States. Do we want to have, Levi Strauss just shut down the last blue jean factory a year or so ago. Do we want to make blue jeans in the United States? Is that, you know, do we want to make fabrics? Do we want to have textile mills? Might we need that stuff? You know, our border patrol is wearing uniforms made in Mexico. I mean, that's how weird it gets. So, did I answer your question, David? Probably not.
Yeah, well, no, it sounds like what you're saying is that in the long run, we're not doing those folks any favors.
We're not. And in fact, if you look at what happened with NAFTA with Mexico, you know, there was a surge in the maquiladora factories, you know, and all these factories. Then what happened? As soon as the Mexican standard of living started coming up and people started demanding trade unions and a higher wage and maybe a little health care or something, then those companies started shutting down those factories and going to China. As soon as China reaches that point, I mean, we saw this with Taiwan, we saw it with Korea, we saw it with Japan. As soon as they reach that point, then they'll go someplace else, you know. And there's, you know, when you've got half the planet, half the human beings on the planet, 3.5 billion humans, on 3.2 billion humans on planet Earth living on less than $2 a day, there's a lot of cheap labor out there in a lot of countries that will be simply the next big country where the multinational corporations go.
So it sounds like if we want to help those people, it has to be done a different way.
Yeah, what we do is we create an example, which is how we used to do it. I mean, everybody wanted to be like the United States, both with human rights and economically. You create an example of how you build a strong economy internally, a self-sustaining internal economy with strong self-sustaining internal industries. And then you engage in trade to get those things that you yourself either don't want to make or can't make. I mean, we're not going to be in the sandalwood business, you know. We'll buy that from India. David, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour.
What have we done?
daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman program. Filling in also this week and next for Al Franken. This is where the rubber meets the road. Just to wrap up, I mean, this is the point that I've been getting to with this hour. And this is the article by Jackie Calms in today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, Trade Fiscal Goals Split Ranks as Democrats Plan Their Agenda. And those of you who are longtime listeners of the program know I have been pointing out for years on this show that there is a battle going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. Is the Democratic Party going to be run by the corporatists, the Republican lights, who have been basically running it since 1980? Or is it going to go back to its traditional and progressive roots, back to being the party of Franklin Roosevelt? As Jackie Calms writes in today's Wall Street Journal, with 2 weeks to go before they take control of Congress, Democrats are taking sides in what is shaping up as one of the party's biggest divides, its identity on economic issues. At stake is the legacy of Bill Clinton and his Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, who in the 1980s redefined the formerly protectionist party as a champion of free trade. That establishment view is now under challenge from party populists and organized labor. I'm skipping around in Jackie's article here, by the way. You can read the whole thing over the Wall Street Journal. The Back to the Future push reflects a restiveness among Democratic and independent voters. And they point out, inflation-adjusted wages haven't risen much, if at all, for many Americans in the middle. I would add, since 1980. Employers have been trimming health and retirement benefits, and anxiety about outsourcing has spread from blue-collar factory workers to their white-collar counterparts. How Democrats respond to these concerns will go far towards shaping the coming Congress after they take power in January and in defining the contest for the 2008 presidential nomination. And see, what amazes me is that nobody's talking about this, because they don't even want to acknowledge the existence of the populists and the progressives among the Democratic Party. You won't hear about this on Hardball or on, you know, the talking head shows or on the weekend shows, or, you know, Tim Russert's not going to be talking about. How Democrats, at this early point, New York Senator Hillary Clinton is viewed as promising a continuance of her husband's policies, though advisors say she will seek her own distinct voice. Many populists, meanwhile, see an appealing candidate in former North Carolina Senator John Edwards. And then they talk about how Robert Rubin came to talk to the incoming Democrats, and he said that trade barriers can be tempting, but he warned that they could be counterproductive. He also acknowledged the role of globalization in holding down wages and contributing to income inequality, yet he insisted our country can do very well, only with free trade. Yeah. Well, there were a number of Democrats at that meeting who said, sorry, guys, you know, Mr. Rubin, we're not going to go along with that. And then you got Rahm Emanuel, who, of course, is part of the, you know, the Clintonistas, pro-trade centrist, whom House Democrats recently elected as their caucus chairman. As a Clinton advisor, Mr. Emanuel helped win passage of NAFTA in 1993. On the party's left, meanwhile, the AFL-CIO is mobilizing along with allies and advocacy groups such as the Campaign for America's Future and the Economic Policy Institute. So, anyhow, it goes on. You can check it out. But that's the battle that's going on. That's the one to really keep your eye on. What's going to happen in the future of the Democratic Party? Brian in Laguna Beach, California. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Welcome to KTLK Los Angeles.
Thank you.
For the week. Great to have you. They love you here. Every other call yesterday was from Southern California, and I talked to their station manager about sending it full time.
Brian, that's not what you called about.
That's not. I wanted to say that really quick. You talk a lot about how the catastrophic effects that all this borrowing is going to be doing, because so much of it has to just so much.
Well, and to some extent, it already is. We're spending $300 billion this year, which is enough to provide free college tuition to every college student in the United States, $300 billion this year just on the interest, just on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up.
Yeah, see now, and that's, I think, really how we have to be communicating it, because for whatever reason, this is not a hot issue for people, because I think the dollar is that they just can't steal them.
Right.
But if you say, like, do you have any idea just in terms of, W's tax cuts and everything, and just what debt he's run up, what percentage of the annual budget goes towards just paying interest? Do you know roughly what that might be? If it's like
I don't have it in front of me right now. It's you know, in my recollection is it's in the neighborhood of around 15-16%, something like that.
Oh, okay, perfect. So if that's what it is, if it's 15%, then we need to make that, you know, one out of every seven, you know, vets is not going to get, you know, health care, and 15% is roughly about one.
Yeah,
out of
I mean, the average American taxpayer this year is going to pay about $2,300 on the national debt. I remember that. I think that's a fairly reasonable, clear memory. The bottom line is, like I said, we are paying interest right now on the money that Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush have borrowed. We're paying interest this year to the tune of over $300 billion, which is enough money to send 14 million college students for full four-year scholarships. I mean, that's where it just gets absolutely crazy. I got to move along here, Brian. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Maurice in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Maurice, what's up? We have less than a minute here to wrap the show up.
Tom, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, it's good to talk to you. Had to disagree with you quickly. The DLC is what created the corporatist movement. That was a reaction to Jesse Jackson's run in 1984. But I got three quick...
I don't disagree with you.
I got three quick points. First and foremost, you are my favorite talk show host, you and Charlie Rose, because you have an intellectually based talk program, which, if you're going to have a discussion about politics, is where it should be. Secondly, I'm starting a movement to turn the word conservative away and start calling them what they are, regressives, because that's what they are.
Yeah, I just call them cons. I think that describes it well. And third point real fast, Maurice.
This is the reason that they elected Reagan was because of reacting to the civil rights movement.
You're absolutely right. You know, and Maurice, we need to talk about that at more length. I hope you will call later in the week, because we're just flat out of time here right now. But tomorrow I'll be challenging conservative Ann Jacobson on the impact of profiling and the effect or non-effect it has on terrorism. In Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, believe it or not, John Curtis is here to say love is a business, how FedEx, IBM, and Nike can save your marriage. What? In the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People, also filling in for Al Franken this week and next. And don't ever forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.